Good evening. I'm Kilowatt 2, Romeo India Whiskey. Along with Mel, Kilowatt 2, Kilo Echo Yankee. The two of these guys try to run a thing called the Technical Myth. They try to organize a gathering of the clan where amateur radio operators get together and they help each other. There's a lot of knowledge out there in the tri-state area, and this repeater covers a certain portion of that tri-state area. Electronics and wireless electronics in particular is a little bit complicated. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. We try to teach each other what each of the 26 kinds are like and how to make them work better and how to have more fun with it and how to understand it a little bit more. It's my belief that inside of each true ham radio operator there's a kind of a scientist wishing to get out and understand the nature makes all this stuff work. How does radio propagation work? How do transmission lines work? How does that final stage of my transmitter do all that? How does that low noise front end of my receiver do all that good high sensitivity stuff? A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick. I'm Dick. Give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in might sound like this, N2NNU, Alex and yes, or W-H-U-R-Y-Y, Joe and yes. So these are people that are some of the frequent sign-ins. Please give me your call letters right now and your name, and that yes or no, K-2-R-I-W listening. John?
K-E-Y, Dick, can I say something before we begin?
You sure can, Mel, go ahead.
Okay, I've got several emails here. Please, can we leave a little time for them? Because I promised that we could answer these. I just can't pound out an answer to a number of these questions on the keyboard. So I know we haven't been getting to the emails, so I'd like to try to, you know, put some time aside just to cover some of them, Dick, over.
Very fine. Mel, name a time in which you think, on the clock, we should switch over. 10:30. Name a time.
If we switch over, let's take the last hour. I told them that I will try at the utmost to make the last hour only for emails, say starting at 11 o'clock this evening. Over.
Okay, if things are a little bit slow, 10:30 or 11 o'clock, switch over to emails. There was a man with an extremely weak signal named John. I didn't hear his call letters. I did hear the word John, and he said, "I have a question." So if you're on a handy talkie, John, you're going to have to move to a different place that we can hear that signal. And I'm listening on both the input and the output of the machine, and as I said, essentially unintelligible. You got to recognize the fact that on a repeater, the transmit frequency and the receive frequency are slightly different, 600 kc apart. So when you move your handy talkie around so you get the strongest signal on receive, it might not be the location where you get the strongest transmission to the repeater. So you got to try another location. So please, people, give us your call letters, your name, and the yes or no if you've got a question or a comment for the net. K2RIW listening.
This is Kilo Charlie Tango Delta Lima. My name is John, and yes, I got a question.
That time we got you, John. Tango Delta Lima. Okay, we got John. Who's the next person to sign in?
K2RIY, Joe. Yes, question.
Okay, we got Joe, and we had a double that time. We got Joe with a yes. Who else? Triple that time. KC2 something. Give me the KC2 and your name and your yes or no.
KC2MDP. Steve and yes, Dick.
We got Steve with a yes. Anyone else?
WS2N, Paul, with a space update.
Yeah, we got to get to Paul earlier too. We waited till the wee hours of midnight last week to get to Paul, and we didn't hear about all the water of the discovering on the moon. So we got to get to you a little earlier tonight, Paul. Okay, we got Paul. Who else would like to check in? Give you a call, letter's name, and a yes or no.
KB2UKA, Doug, no.
We got Doug with a no. Anyone else? Okay, that's more than enough to start off. Let's start off with John, KC2 Tango Delta Lima. Glad you were able to increase your signal, John. K2RIW, go right ahead.
Yeah, I moved my mobile rig in my basement. Listen, the question is that I have an atomic watch, and it doesn't really receive signals from the atomic clock in, I think, Colorado. And, I was just wondering how could I get to receive a better signal, because, you know, I live in not a particularly high interference zone, but, you know, there's power lines and there's all this hogwash in the air. So I was just wondering, you know, if there's a place I can put it to get it to receive a signal better.
I mean, 2081, but a comment about that? Go right ahead, Joe.
They own a couple of those clocks, and what they say in the instructions for those things is you have an experience where you experience poor reception or it doesn't pick up the signal from Boulder, Colorado. They say try moving it near a large window. That will help in the reception because you're receiving a 60 kilohertz signal.
Well done, John. I mean, Joe. Yeah, you and I, John, are very familiar with VHF propagation. And a VHF signal can get through a building with metal girders, as long as the metal girders have got enough spacing so that the wavelength can squeeze in them. VHF can get through a lot of stuff except a mile of dense, moist forest that will attenuate the daylight out of the signal. Go down to the frequencies that are used for timing from Boulder, Colorado, 60 kilohertz. The wavelength is huge, and as such, different things will stop that signal. Very different things. So it doesn't penetrate buildings very well. An open window that faces toward Boulder, Colorado, is my guess, is worth a try. Altitude will help a little bit, but getting it away from dense stuff. The walls of your building, 60 kilohertz, are probably fairly opaque. 60 kilohertz will go through a forest, but it won't go through a building. Is my rough guess. So you're going to have to try a number of locations and a number of orientations of the watch. At 60 kilohertz, you haven't got the ability to squeeze into that tiny little watch an antenna that has circular polarization and is omnidirectional, you know, receive signals from all directions. The best you can do to build an antenna in that thing is to make either a H-field probe or a E-field probe, but it's probably a purely linear antenna, and it's got a particular polarization that it favors. And the ionosphere itself has got its crazy characteristics at 60 kilohertz. So a big open window aimed to the west toward Boulder, and different orientations of the watch, and if the watch is in good operating order, I think you're going to find an orientation and a place in your house where you'll get better reception. It's going to take some experimenting. What they're selling with that watch is a technique that works a certain percentage of the time. I think you're going to discover that 60 kilohertz propagation is affected by the ionosphere, the sunspot cycle, the day and night, and whatever. I believe these watches are designed to do something like looking for that signal at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're not roaming around. It's got enough time to find the signal and reset itself. These are some of the things I believe I know about these so-called atomic watches. Let me pass it back to you, John. Drag your feet in case there are other people with more information, and make sure the machine has time to reset itself. KC2 Tango Delta Lima with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Check me in, Dick, at 2EO, no questions.
We got you, Rich.
All right, well, you know, I'm just saying that because there have been nights that I've stayed up and actually observed the watch, and it does say that it's very poor signal receiving from my bedroom, and the bedroom's on the second floor. I always pointed towards the window, and it probably only calibrated a few times since I've had it. It's solar-powered, actually, which is good. I don't need to change the battery. What kind of antenna do these watches have? Is it, like, fractal? Is it a simple wire? Is it, like, something in a coil format?
I'm very doubtful that it would be a fractal antenna. I've worked with fractal antennas. I know what they can do and what they can't do. There are two ways you can make an extremely miniature antenna at such an extremely low frequency. As I said before, E-field probe is one technique. I think they're not using that one. H-field probe is more likely. So it's a coil of wire placed somewhere within the watch looking for the magnetic field of the 60 kilohertz signal. This is an extremely sensitive low noise preamplifier front end, and with a little help from Mother Nature and the ionosphere and your proper orientation of the watch. You're going to have to do a little bit of experimenting of laying the watch flat, upside down, on the left-hand edge, the right-hand edge, aim to the north, the south, the east, or the west, while it's in that window to the west. So you'll eventually find an orientation, a position. I'll also try translating it X, Y, and Z in the vicinity of that window, and maybe even putting it up on a cardboard box. Try to keep metallic objects away from it. If you're laying it, for instance, on a metal table, the metal table is a partial shield to the magnetic field that I think that coil of wire is trying to pick up. So putting it on a cardboard box that spaces it up against, up away from things, so it's in free space. The cardboard box is, of course, very transparent to a 60 kilohertz signal. These are some of the things I would try. Back to you, John, for any final comments, and again, drag your feet in case someone else has a suggestion. That Dave Kosabar has also used some of these watches, and if he happens to be on frequency, he may be able to tell us what he's done to increase the probability of getting good reception. KC2, Tango Delta Lima, some delay, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I happen to remember there was some mention that we discussed this once before, maybe a year ago, and somebody did mention that they came up, somebody had a way that they showed you they make a little coupling type of loop up, I believe, it may be on the internet, a coupling loop, and then to a wire, a long wire or whatever, some kind of an antenna, additional antenna that you lay the watch in for the night into this little sort of coupling toroidal or some kind of little device, and it has an additional antenna coupling. This was because we had this discussion, like I say, previous, over.
Fantastic idea. Wish I had thought of that one. There are guys, for instance, who used to put up an antenna on their automobile or on their house and plug it into their cell phone. Cell phones used to have an external jack for the antenna in which you could get much better reception. Cell phones these days don't have an external jack anymore, and you don't even see the antenna, and the performance is a little bit lower. They think everyone wants to see no antenna, and therefore styling dictates performance, if you know, when it comes to the design of a cell phone. But a person could have a good cell phone antenna. I'm using this as an example. Bring it down to the antennas up on the roof of the house or in the attic of the house, and with coax cable brings the signal down and build some kind of a launching device so that the signal that's on that cable gets launched to the cell phone. You put the cell phone near it. But by the same token, 60 kilohertz, the best you're going to do is an end-fed step antenna. That's a fancy way of saying a long piece of wire. Should it be horizontal or vertical? I don't know. But a long piece of wire, and the end of the piece of wire near the watch, and there may be a way of coiling the end of the wire to give increased coupling to the watch. But a nice long piece of wire that's insulated as a pickup device, and then the end of the wire in the proximity of the watch could make a huge improvement. And when you find the solution, John, I think you should write an article. I think you should tell the technician first before you sneak this article off to CQ, QST, Ham Radio, whatever magazine, and get a whole lot of money. A little bit of a joke there. But I guarantee there is a solution by which you can build an augmentation antenna, and once it's properly laid in your house, maybe the wire itself could be, thumbtacked across the ceiling, so to speak, and colored the same way, so it goes down the wire, no one even sees it, and goes across your window, and you put your watch in that area. Something as simple as that could make a huge improvement, because the big problem the watch manufacturer had is he's trying to build an antenna with a half mile wavelength, and he's trying to squeeze that into a watch that's, what, 1.5 inches in diameter? Obviously, there's a huge compromise going on there, and you could put back some of the antenna that he didn't have the ability to put in. And you don't have to make direct contact with that antenna. Just bringing your watch in the vicinity will pick up some of that signal. Very similar to what some of the guys do when it comes to AM radio DXing. You can buy this great big ferrite-like thing that's tunable. You lay your AM radio across it, and it picks up much better signals, and you can start listening to KFR, I think it is, in Los Angeles on a good night when they've got clear channel. They're the only station on the air on that exact frequency. And here in New York, you can be listening to an AM station in Canada, Los Angeles. So external augmentation of a radio device is a fun experiment. Let us know how it turns out, even if it doesn't work at first, John. KC2TDL. Don, good question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Cop, do I have to land on this topic?
Paul recognized. Was there another person? Go right ahead, Paul.
I have two clocks. I don't have the watch. And one up here on the main floor, surrounded by ham radio equipment. That works almost every day, no problem. And the other one I had in the basement. I said, well, this isn't going to work down here, but let me try it anyway. I wanted to have one downstairs. And I put it here and put it there. And no go. I would have to bring it upstairs and let it sit overnight. And then it would reset itself. Then I got the idea. I don't know if this is possible or if it's just a coincidence, like you said, Dick, where you put it. But I put it, you know, I have a cable for the cable TV down. I don't know if he does. And I put it right up, right next to the cable. And it's been good like that ever since the last couple of months. So I don't know if the signal's getting in there. I know, you know, one time you could, you know, take your cable from your TV and you could, you know, plug it into your FM radios and AM radios. And, you know, you got pretty, you know, good reception. So, well, maybe the signal is getting in on that. And maybe I'm getting the code and it's coming through. You know, just whatever leakage you get, you know, near a cable wire. Possible, but I don't know, Dick. But, you know, give it a shot. It works for me. It just could be coincidence, like you said. You know, you could put it anywhere and maybe it'll work. Back to you, Dick.
I think you're onto something, Paul. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I'll admit that the shielding of the coaxial cable used for cable television is not going to be very much 60 kilohertz signal on the inside of that cable. But the outside conductor of the cable is insulated with another layer of polyethylene plastic on top of it. So the outer shield of that cable fits the requirement of what we're telling John to do. That cable goes down the block for miles. Although it is DC grounded, if you did a real good experiment at 60 kilohertz, you'd find out it's a floating system. And so just bringing a watch near the outside jacket with the plastic insulation on the jacket of the cable. That cable is going to be a probe that's picking up some of that 60 kilohertz signal, and the watch being close to it is going to couple to it. So your Cat5 cabling in your house, your coax cabling for cable television, even a slim possibility of the 60 cycle power line. That I'm a little bit more skeptical about because of the severe grounding that takes place at the fuse battle of almost every house. But you don't have it with the cable. So the cable television outer jacket, just putting the watch near it, is worth a try. Another experiment. And when John does all these experiments, we're giving you a lot of homework here, John. When you do all these experiments and come back to us and tell us which ones work, which orientation, how close, where in the house, and so on. I bet you there's a lot more places where 60 kilohertz is present in your house and you don't know it because very few of us own a 60 kilohertz sniffing receiver. A scanner that goes down that low, and therefore we don't get a chance to test where the signal is in the house. However, there are also articles about how to build a 60 kilohertz converter, which up-converts it to some other ham radio frequency or scanner frequency, and you can start listening to those signals directly and building a portable version of that. You could walk around the neighborhood, around your house, the different floors of the house, the different rooms, and whatever, and find out where the signal is present. So, the whole unexplored world here, John. KC2, Tango Delta Lima, KQRAW.
wire run across where the watch is and actually receive a signal that way. I've done that several times with AM radios. I built one AM radio. It was a 7-transistor AM radio, and I actually ran a wire across the antenna on the radio, and I got a better signal. I did the same thing with a crystal radio set that I was using an audio amplifier for. And the reason why I asked you about the antenna was because I have a few schematics that allow you to receive WWV signals from the WWV signals. Yeah, but that's why I was asking.
K2K, Wilder, comment.
Okay, Mel recognized. Yeah, the WWV signals for time, 2.5, 5, 10, and 15 megacycles, that requires a somewhat similar antenna, but way down at 60 kilohertz, the antenna looks very different again, a good working antenna. So some more experimentation is going to be required, as I see it. Not quite the same. But go right ahead, Mel.
You reminded me of something many years ago when we were youngsters, I know, back in the dark, and just I used to build crystal radios, and my antenna, I used to clip it to the telephone dial, you know, the finger stop, that little silver that they used to have on the old rotary dial phone. That finger stop used to work as a perfect antenna for crystal radios, Dick, over.
And once again, you're connected to a nice long piece of twisted pair wire that goes all the way back to the central station of your telephone company. And it's got a grounding device in your house as far as lightning protection is concerned. But for the most part, that wiring is a beautiful antenna. That's what you discovered when you connected to the old dial telephone. And you used to have a metal outer case, too, which again gives you good coupling. So the word antenna and aerial is mysterious. And there's a hell of a lot of things that the eye says, no, that can't be an antenna. But you better believe it is. When it comes to putting antennas on law enforcement vehicles, every slot in the sheet metal of the automobile is capable of being an antenna. There are antennas that were made out of a side view mirror, and where the fender meets the body of the car, put some insulation there under the paint, and you can build an antenna in it. So any interruption of any piece of metal is capable of being made into an antenna. So the wiring in your house for telephone, cable TV, Cat5 cabling, for interconnecting computers, any of these things can become antennas at these very low frequencies, medium low, low frequencies, and so on. So good luck with those experiments, John. I think Steve, KC2MDP, the voice of, is it Lindbrook? I think he lives in Lindbrook. No, Baldwin. The voice of Baldwin. Go right ahead, Steve. K2LIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, the voice of Baldwin. Dick, I got a question here that's sort of puzzling me. I'll give you the details here. I recently bought one of the those motorized screwdriver antennas. And the instructions, there's a couple of do's and don'ts. And there's three don'ts there that really is a head-scratcher for me. Number one is it says don't use an antenna analyzer. You know, it says an antenna analyzer won't work. It won't give you the proper reading as far as SWR. Use the power meter on the radio itself. Number two head-scratchers, it says don't use a wire for your ground to the vehicle. You know, the sheet metal in your vehicle, use a strap instead. That I can understand, but I can't really see where a wire wouldn't work. And head scratch number three is it says use their mag mount if you're going to use a mag mount. That other types of mag mounts won't work. I mean, so I went ahead, I did the strap, I used my own mag mount because they already had it, and I used an antenna analyzer, and the antenna analyzer seems to work fine. I mean, I got the SWR down to about the highest SWR I get doing this thing is about 1.8. Just a couple of, you know, quick words on this. Why would they, you know, say, you know, big no-no, don't use an analyzer. You got to use our use on mag mount, and the ground straps, I can understand that, but I still can't figure out why just a piece of, you know, heavy wire from, you know, the mount itself to the sheet metal in the car, why wouldn't that work? Back to you, Dick.
I've got some guesses as what could be going on here, Steve. Number one, an antenna analyzer requires interpretation. Some of the antenna analyzers are only mediocre in their accuracy. And some of the antenna analyzers, under certain conditions, give readings that will lead you astray. So the interpretation, the proper interpretation and calibration and verification of an antenna analyzer is a whole subject in itself. I mean, of a similar vein, we can start off talking about the signal strength meter that's on our receivers, the S-meter. It is a reasonable relative indicator. But the original definition of an S-meter, which I think was defined by Collins Radio, is that S9 is supposed to be 50 microvolts, and every other S-unit is half that voltage. S8 is 25 microvolts. S7 is 12.5 microvolts, and so on. That was the original definition of an S-meter. Essentially, none of the radios you and I can buy today come anywhere near meeting those criteria. And you could, with a signal generator, calibrate your S-meter. By the same token, when you start off with an antenna analyzer, it would be nice to start off with a pair of known 50-ohm loads, put them into a T connector. Obviously, a pair of 50-ohm loads in parallel makes 25 ohms, and the center of that T connector should be 25. Put that on your analyzer as a calibration device, and it should read 2.00 standing wave ratio. And it should tell you you're connected to 25 ohms resistive, and very little ohms of reactance. That's what it should tell you. And then put it on a known good 50-ohm resistor. It should say that. And maybe a 100-ohm resistor and so on. There's ways you can check the calibration of your antenna analyzer. And I think if guys were smart enough to do that, in some cases they would get a little bit disappointed. However, it's not a showstopper. They can either come up with a calibration curve, know how to correct what your antenna analyzer reads, and or get in there and actually rebalance the network itself that's doing the sensing and make it more accurate. A buddy of mine recently made a bunch of readings of an antenna at the salt mine, a 2-meter antenna, and he had one set of readings where the antenna analyzer was telling him the resistive and the reactive component, and the exact same set of readings it was telling him the standing wave ratio, and I decided to check the mathematics. And in quite a few places it didn't check. So let me drop. That's part of what I think is going on. As long as you know you've got a reasonably good antenna analyzer, I would believe it. There's almost no way that it could be lying to you. And it's telling you what the transmitter is going to see. That determines whether or not your transmitter is going to be happy. When it comes to the mag mount, if I'm at a VHF frequency, the mag mount has got a big enough magnet metal plate inside that comes close to the automobile, and there's a simple piece of plastic separating the two to make sure I don't scratch the paint on my car. That gives you a huge coupling capacitor, and therefore your mag mount is extremely well grounded when it's connected to the metal surface of the car at VHF frequencies. But if I take that exact same mag mount and use it on 80 meters, that same number of picofarad between the magnet and the car is nowhere near as good an absolute ground. It's a significantly high capacitor reactance at that low frequency. So therefore, if I properly tune the screwdriver antenna for a mag mount application, I'm tuning it for a particular capacitor of a particular brand name of mag mount. And so if I go from brand name A to brand name B of mag mount, I may have half or twice the number of picofarads, and when it comes to that antenna, that's a significant portion of the antenna. There's nothing wrong with putting a capacitor between the bottom of the antenna and the sheet metal of the car, as long as the antenna is properly tuned to accommodate that capacitor. In your case, the antenna tuner is telling you whether or not it's tuned. So you've got a closed loop there, and I'm positive you don't have to use exactly their brand of mag mount once you know that. Similarly, when it comes to the grounding straps, they have a recommended way where the grounding straps present a particular amount of series inductive reactance, which they've also possibly made part of the tuning of the antenna. And if you use some other drastically different method of using grounding straps, you're going to end up with a different inductance at the bottom, and in theory the antenna requires another tuning to do it. That's my best guesses as to what's going on here. But I think you're on the right track with testing your antenna tuner, making sure it gives you answers that you understand or are reasonable, and using it to test the integrity of the mag mount. I'm positive it's the right thing to do. You'll discover that, let me drop one more time. There's many a person who will call up an antenna manufacturer, talk to some knowledgeable sounding person at the factory, who makes pronouncements that sound like it's traceable to the bureau, and it was the MS. It sounds that way, but when you dig into the details, you find out the person really didn't have very much knowledge, the person who's giving you all these great answers. I think one-third of the time, a person calling up an antenna manufacturer, asking a technical question, I think one-third of the time they get an answer that's reasonably wrong, particularly when it comes to proper spacing of VHF antennas, and how to build phasing harnesses and whatever, and proper methods of mounting around metallic objects. I've heard all kinds of answers that I'm convinced are primarily wrong. So the fact that it's in the data sheet for the antenna doesn't mean it's traceable to the Bureau, and I think you're closer to the truth as I see it, Steve. KC2MDP, KQRIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Jake, yeah, very good explanation. Everything makes sense to me. Like I said, you know, when I use my own back now, I did use the ground straps, but they were easy enough to build them. Like plug a rack in a car to ground it. Now, the only thing that's weird, though, is you said something about the capacitance and stuff on the VHF versus VHF frequency. Now, what I found, it could be the analyzer, is I had just the opposite. You know, this thing goes from 6 to 80 meters. So I tuned it to 6 meters, and the SWR was, I'd say about 1.8 was probably the best I could get it if I played a little toggle switch to move the antenna coil up and down. But on 80 meters, I got a perfect match of 1 to 1, which I couldn't understand unless it's my analyzer. It even said something in the manual that, you know, 6 to 10 meters might be the tough one to tune. If you don't, and if you can't, you have to use a second ground strap. I put two anyway. But I just found, you know, I found the exact opposite, that on 80 of you use it was perfect. And up at 6, it was 1.8. Back to you.
Got a comment, KTKEY.
Well recognized. And Steve, you heard my words, but you got the wrong interpretation of them. All I'm saying is that the capacitor reactance of the capacitor of the mag mount is a bigger capacitor reactance. In other words, let's assume now that the capacitance between your magnet and the sheet metal of the car through that piece of plastic of your mag mount, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, let's say it's 100 picofarads. 100 picofarads at 2 meters is a fairly small reactance, only a couple of ohms. 100 picofarads at 80 meters is a lot of capacitor reactance. Maybe it's a 500 ohms. However, if the antenna is properly tuned to accommodate that capacitor reactance at 80 meters, you can get a beautiful match. So more capacitor reactance, less coupling through the capacitor at the lower frequency, doesn't mean the antenna stops working. It just means that the antenna has to be tuned differently to accommodate that capacitor and re-hit resonance. The real magic of all of our antennas, with the exception of rhombic and beverage, which are a zillion wavelengths long. That's a traveling wave antenna. Every other antenna we touch, with rare exception, is a standing wave antenna. That means the signal has to bounce back and forth some significant number of times before it gets radiated into space. Those bounces have to all be in step with each other in order for radiation to take place. The other set of words you and I call that is resonance. So the bottom line is this is, if you're going to build a good antenna at any of these frequencies we use, you resonate it first, then it can radiate. So even though you get a bigger capacitive reactance out of that mag mount capacitor at 80 meters, that's not a showstopper, as long as you resonate it. If you get good resonance on 80 meters out of lossless materials, you're going to radiate like a banshee. K2KEY, K2RIW, wait for the beep.
Roger. Some years ago,
Communications Quarterly did a very good series, an article by this one ham, although a doctor, a PhD, had a PhD, and he did a lot of the detailed experiments and went through quite a number of these handheld analyzers and showed how easily he could fool them. Did a very good laboratory setup and how he performed the test. And basically, he showed the accurate way to do your measurements. He was using is a actually measuring RL, return loss coefficient, in dB. And in fact, actually, you know, using a directional coupler as the proper way to really measure the antenna, because the almost all the handhelds, maybe some of the newer ones now have come up, maybe are somewhat improved, but he showed how many times he was able to drastically fool what was being marketed, Dick, over.
Good point. And what Mel's really getting to here is the law of conservation of energy. It's what you're hearing left-handedly. Of all that beautiful, high-performance, expensive power, radio power that your transmitter generates, that goes flying down that transmission line, there's only three things that can happen to it. Hopefully a lot of it hits the antenna absorbs it and radiates it into space. That's what we really desire, that's the good news. The other thing the power can happen to it when it goes down the transmission line is the transmission line is lossy, the antenna is lossy, and some of it gets burned up into heat. That's the only real way you lose RF energy, you burn it up into heat. That's item number two. Item number three, because the antenna is not well impedance matched to your transmission line. If your transmission line says it is 50 ohms, then your antenna better be a 50 ohm resistor with no other reactants in order to absorb 100% of the power that gets to the antenna. If the antenna is any other resistor with any amount of reactants, some amount of power will reflect from the antenna. The ratio of the reflected power to the forward power, it's in mathematics, we call it standing wave ratio, or we call it reflected voltage ratio, or we call it reflected power ratio, or we call it the S11, the scattering parameters. So with a directional couple, or with a directional, let me drop for a second, with a directional coupler, or a well-calibrated Berg wattmeter, or an antenna bridge, an antenna analyzer, standing wave ratio measurement, all of these things are telling you what is the reflection coefficient. What percentage of the power going down the antenna transmission line was not accepted by the antenna and reflected back. In the ideal world, you'd like 100 watts going forward and less than 1 watt coming back. That's the ideal world. But the amount of watts coming back is telling you something. It's a very important message. And if you can fiddle with the antenna and its mechanism around it and the impedance matching devices and the coupling coefficient so that the reflected power goes toward zero while the forward power stays the same or increases, you do that and you're making the antenna performance improve. So an antenna analyzer properly used, a directional coupler properly used, a Berg wattmeter looking at reflected power properly used, any of these things are telling you that valuable piece of information, the third component. The first component is radiation. The second component is absorption and turn into heat. And the third component is reflected power. And the best you can do is to fiddle to make the reflected power go to zero. You do that, you're going to get the highest performance. And where Steve just told us that at 80 meters, he has a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. Assuming his antenna analyzer is telling him the truth, that implies that almost all the power going down that transmission line is hitting the antenna, and the antenna is accepting it and radiating as much of it as it can into space, depending on whether or not the antenna itself has an internal loss mechanism. And if the antenna itself had an internal loss mechanism, you can find that out real fast. Run the transmitter at 10 watts or 100 watts, key down, for a couple of minutes. Turn the transmitter off, run over there, and touch everything. The only real mechanism of true loss at RF frequencies is to absorb the RF energy and turn it into heat. 1 watt of heat is something your hand can easily detect after a couple of minutes. 1 watt out of 100 watts is an extremely good ratio, you know, 99% efficiency. So the hand warm test, to touch, the hand touching warm pieces of antenna, after you've run this couple of minute test at power, turn up the transmitter and go up there and touch everything, that will give you immediate indication as to whether or not there's inefficiency taking place. If you want to be sophisticated about it, use a thermal imaging camera, which I do as a professional. Let me stop one more time. There are times when occupationally I'm forced to build antennas into extremely small packages under severe environments with local metallic objects shielding the antenna unintentionally. A 14-layer printed circuit board, and the RF signal is going to the third layer of the board through a via hole, goes somewhere down the board, comes back up, and eventually goes to an antenna. Which portion of that system is efficient or inefficient, I find out real fast by putting a lot of power into the antenna, aiming a thermal imaging camera at it in a dark room, so to speak, and watch what starts to glow on the thermal imaging camera. It tells you immediately who's eating your lunch. And if you find out that, hey, somebody substituted a brand A printed circuit board instead of brand B because it was a little bit cheaper, but it had a little bit higher loss tangent, and now your RF energy is being eaten up by the loss of that particular printed circuit board. And you could then make a decision that, hey, for the couple of pennies I'm saving, am I willing to throw away half the power that's being wasted by the PC board? You can get real strong evidence real fast as to, as I said, who's eating your lunch, and you can decide, is it cost-effective to make an improvement? So once you understand the physics of how an antenna works, you guys have the instrumentation. Sometimes it's the tips of your fingers are damn good instrumentation to tell you what's working and what isn't working. KC2MPP, K2RIW. Oh, was it Mel, did you have another comment you wanted to make?
Oh, not really. Mania that goes on, like you say, with measuring FWR and a number of other factors of how people literally, you know, I've heard them many a time, of course, on 75 meters, bemoaning the fact that they can't get their FWR down much below 1 to 1.5. Or if they do, after going through tremendous amounts of worker time, find that they only want to hear, well, how much better is my signal, you know, people that they talk to every night, how much better is my signal if not I'm down to 1.2 now or whatever, and they're not convinced that what they're hearing from back from the people that they talk to, that there may be no difference at all, or sometimes because of conditions that they're even weaker and all, this is something they just can't deal with. I mean, I heard some of the things that they went ahead and got themselves into, thinking that it's got to make improvement just by lowering that so-called SWR a couple of points. It's ridiculous. And the same thing you alluded to with the S-meter, how people get so upset if they don't hear a 5.9. You dare not give a DX station a report that's not at least 5.9, Dick, over.
I used to get around that problem by taking the S-meter that was on my receiver, which had a calibration that was really yucky. I started off with a good signal generator and putting in 1 microvolt and 50 microvolts and 100 microvolts and so on. I made a calibration curve. And because people didn't want to hear anything but S9, I didn't tell them S9. I said, you're giving me 47 microvolts today. You gave me 31 microvolts yesterday. I'm giving them something that is almost traceable to the Bureau, and I'm not using the vocabulary that is troublesome to them. I'm giving them a more exact answer. All of a sudden, I had a whole lot of people on 432. Every time they made a change in their system, they would call me up and say, hey, Dick, look on your 3x5 card file. Tell me what I was a month ago. I made this and that change. Did I make any improvement? So guys were using me as a testing station, 1, 2, 10, 50, 100, 200 miles away to tell them their signal was better or worse. Gotta be careful, though. Particularly on what Mel was just mentioning, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, the average person would really lose a lot of sleep over that one. And modern-day no-tune transmitters have trouble accepting 2-to-1. Some of them beyond 1.5-to-1, they start cutting back in power. So a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, as bad as that sounds, means that the reflected power is creating a true loss, worst case, of half a dB. Half a dB is 1/12 of a properly calibrated S meter. One S unit is 6 dB. Half a dB of difference is 1/12 of an S unit. Can you see that on your S meter? I doubt it. With a magnifying glass against the meter, if it's the old Delta Val movement, maybe. But there's a catch. You're talking to a guy in Pennsylvania, and you're on here on Long Island, and the signal is a near-vertical incident sky wave signal reflecting off the ionosphere.
K7KEG, K7BBQ.
Greetings and welcome to the worldwide PX linking system. We hope you enjoy the system while making new friends around the world. Our website.
The joys of having an internet connection. For those who are listening, this is the TechNet on Long Island from the W2VL repeater, and I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey with K2KEY as the two moderators. What I was starting to say is that near-vertical incident sky wave that goes from Long Island to your buddy in Pennsylvania that requires the ionosphere, that ionosphere can easily make the signal between today and tomorrow, or between this morning and this afternoon, 10 or 20 decibels different in signal strength. So the ionosphere as a random variable of polarization and amplitude and sky wave and angle of incident and whatever, all the things that Mother Nature can do to you can make the signal go up and down 10 or 20 dB. And you've made a change from 2 to 1 Vizwar down to 1 to 1 Vizwar, and you've improved by half a dB, 1/12 of 1 S unit, in the presence of a random variable of 10 or 20 dB of the ionosphere. So if you use that as a judgment to be happy or unhappy today because of the S meter reading your buddy in Pennsylvania is giving you, and if you want to believe all that, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn that Mel used to own, and I bought it from him, and I'll sell it to you. So be careful how you use those readings. Go ahead back to you, Stan. I'm Steve. We got a little bit off your subject, but it's a fun one. KC2MDP, K2LIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Now I'm not going to lose any sleep over a 1.8 sending wave ratio. You know, I learned my lesson on 6 meters when I was, field day, when I was working 5 watts and I was working into Utah and down south into Florida, into Texas and stuff, with a fairly crummy antenna, and that impressed me. So a little bit of a loss and a 1.8 SWR, I certainly am not going to lose any sleep. So long as my transmitter's happy, I'm happy. And thank you, Dick. Thank you, Mel, for your comments and your answers. Once again, they are great, great. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Hey, Mel, we got a happy customer. We got to send him another bill. One other thing going on here. When I talk about half a dB of loss with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, that's the exact calculation, if and only if, the transmitter was a pure 50-ohm source. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is 9.5 dB of reflection coefficient, almost a 10-to-1 ratio. So if I put 100 watts down the cable, roughly 9.5 watts or so is coming back if I have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And if the transmitter was a 2-to-1, a exact 50-ohm source, it would absorb that reflected power. Well, no transmitter you and I own does that. That final stage is a near constant current generator, a tetrode tube or a power transistor. And by way of your antenna tuner, all of that reflected power gets re-reflected forward. You don't even lose the half a dB. You lose a couple of tenths of it because the signal bouncing back and forth in the transmission line. So there's many a case where Mel and Dick and others have had a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio on the real antenna with a reasonable piece of RG8 coax cable and an antenna tuner or a Pi network in the old-fashioned transmitters that had enough tuning range. We easily accommodated that particular phase angle of a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. As far as the transmitter is concerned, he thought it was a 50-ohm load. And 90-some-odd percent of that power went into the antenna, and the guy in South America told Mel or Dick, hey, you're 5 and 9 down here. You may think you've got a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna, and you think it's going to die. Not necessarily. So the interpretation of standing wave ratio is one of the big subjects of controversy and a lot of misunderstanding in ham radio. Of all the subjects that Mel and I run into where there's big misunderstanding, antennas, standing wave ratio, and transmission line are near the top of the list of areas of misunderstanding and senseless arguments and people pontificating. I'm pontificating right now. But of course I know I'm right. Here we go. Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, we're going to have our feedback on the ground, and what are you doing, and how are things on the South Shore today, Joe? W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. A little bit of a delay.
All right. K-2-R-I-W, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. I have a question on a subject I was talking to another amateur on via the Internet, and the initial subject was on geocaching, which is not what I'm going to ask about. But within that subject, talking about that subject and learning something about it, he mentioned a term called WAAS, and this had to do with GPS reception. Can you elaborate more on this? You know much about it? He said it had something to do, or quite a bit to do with the basic accuracy of a newer unit compared to an older unit.
I'm not positive, but I think WAAS stands for Wide Area Augmentation System. If I understand it correctly, with a little bit of study, global positioning satellite receiver systems and transmitter systems, the GPS system is quite a bit of magic. You've got a constellation of approximately 24 active satellites in, I think, six different orbital planes, and three satellites per orbital plane, if I got it right, it was four. Four satellites per orbital plane, six orbital planes, and all these satellites are zipping around at 10,000 mile altitude. Every one of those satellites is extremely carefully aligned with, let's call it Boulder, Colorado, the National Bureau of Standards, and they've got an onboard clock that's extremely accurate. And they're sending out a very well-timed signal. And your receiver on the ground hopefully picks up three, four, or more of those satellites, compares the timing of the signal coming from the satellite, and it doesn't triangulate, it trilaterates, or it quadrilaterates. And if you pick up more and more satellites, you do what's called the overdetermined solution. You now start using groups of satellites together in various combinations. Each group of satellites with the trilateration algorithm on board gives you an apparent position on the Earth in latitude, longitude, and altitude. And if you calculate your apparent position with the first three satellites and then the next three satellites and then another combination of satellites, you eventually get a cluster of apparent positions. And a well-tuned receiver, a well-designed receiver, looks at the mathematics of all that, looks at the signal strength. In other words, he weights the quality of the signals that are nice and strong. He'll give them more validity than the signals that are weak, and therefore he has more faith in that apparent position. So you get a cluster of positions as to where the satellite, your GPS receiver, thinks you are. Let me drop. And for a whole bunch of reasons of atmospheric characteristics, how good is your receiver, where are those particular satellites today, are they favorably located, all, you know, 30 degrees from zenith at your location would be very ideal, as opposed to being all right on the horizon or only one of them overhead and the rest of them on the horizon. That's a much less desirable situation for accurately figuring out your position. You're going to get a certain amount of error. And I've heard errors of numbers like 15 meters at least is the error in your apparent position, and maybe sometimes even bigger numbers. However, if there is a control station nearby for the GPS system, which is simultaneously measuring the apparent position of that control station, and that control station, somebody has carefully set him up with a geodetic survey map, he knows exactly where he is. And if he thinks he's at latitude such and such and longitude so and so, and if the apparent position giving him from the global positioning satellite receiver system puts him 45 feet away to the north, he starts broadcasting a signal that at this time, for this near vicinity, whatever apparent position you've got, subtract 45 feet to the south in order to correct for what the atmospheric conditions are doing today. So with that WAAS signal broadcast from a local station that's in your vicinity, you know what the error in the system is for that locality at this hour of this day, and you can take it back out, and therefore the accuracy of what you now figure out as your true location can drastically improve. That's my understanding. I know I've got a couple of errors, but I'm hoping I'm close to the concept of how this WAAS system works. There's got to be some more guys out there with a lot more smarts on GPS. Why don't you sign in right now and straighten us out? KQRIW in the TechNet.
WA2VDH with a comment.
WA2, Victor Delta Hotel, it sounds like. Start up with your name, and then tell us your comment, sir.
Okay, fine, this is Dick. Name is John. I think what you're describing, I'm not sure, but I think you're describing differential GPS, which is a way that they correct the intentional degradation of the GPS signal to prevent it from being used by bad guys, in that they stations are set up which at a known location which receive the GPS signal and, as you say, transmit a correction signal. I think that correction signal is transmitted on low frequency. Go ahead.
Okay, I've heard it slightly differently, John. First of all, the dilution of accuracy that used to be used on GPS no longer exists. In other words, to my knowledge, they're no longer intentionally dithering the signal coming out of the satellite. They're now telling you the real thing. They realize they don't need that anywhere near as much as they thought they did at one time. So that's I call it dilution of position. Anyhow, the intentional error no longer exists. But even with the system now no longer creating an error, like everything else, nothing is perfect. You may think your ruler is really 36 inches long and your yardstick is exactly 39.37 inches long. You may think so. Obviously, there's a certain error in everything that you do. Nothing is perfect. And so the GPS system has an error, and this augmentation system tries to take that error back out. To my knowledge, the intentional error no longer exists. Let me make sure that everyone on frequency agrees with me on that, and after a little bit of delay, pick up John, and we'll see if I'm true on that one. To my knowledge, that intentional error no longer exists as of a couple of years ago. WA2VDH to take it with a delay. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, fine, this is Dick. I have remember reading that it was a few years ago, so I may be a few years out of date on that. I think, though, they still do transmit that information on low frequency. I think that correction signal is transmitted in the 300 to 400 kilohertz range. Go ahead.
Yeah, that could be the way by which you find out what the error is for your locale, for your region, is right now. I'm not sure what frequency it's transmitted on and how it's transmitted, but a well...
At 8 o'clock, welcome to the W2VL repeater.
A modern-day receiver receives not only as many satellites as possible in real time. In other words, it's got a whole lot of truly active channels as opposed to very slow timeshare channels. There's a lot of difference in the receivers that you can buy and their true quality and their amount of time that they lock up from a completely cold start, and how many satellites they got to see simultaneously to give the best readings and whatever. That system still has a built-in error by the laws of physics, not an intentional error by mankind any longer. But to my knowledge, the system has been made as accurate as possible. There's also one other thing you might want to know about, and that is what you think is a GPS system is really, I'm going to call it three different systems. There is the normal civilian code, which runs 1 million bits per second approximately. There is a military code that runs 10 million bits per second and has